You're listening to The Crossover with Joe R. Lucas.
Welcome to the Turkish Airlines EuroLeague's brand new podcast. I'm Joe R. Lucas, and over the next few months, I'll be getting down and dirty with some of your favorite coaches, players, and legends of EuroLeague basketball. Each episode of The Crossover will feature an exclusive chat between me and a very special guest as I find out what life is like on and off the hard court for Europe's elite. We're kicking things off in style with this first episode, and I could not have been more excited to sit down with one of the most distinguished coaches in the game, Olympiakos head coach David Blatt. Hey, Coach, welcome to The Crossover. So happy and honored. You know, just a little bit nervous also about sitting down with one of the best coaches in Europe.
Pleasure, Joe. I'm a little nervous, too. I'm used to seeing you on the other side of the court, and that was pretty nerve-wracking, too.
Is it Coach? Is it David? Is it Mr. Blatt?
I guess whatever works for you works for me.
All right, let's start. A little bit of a life story. A young Jewish boy from just outside of Boston.
Yes.
Framingham.
Framingham, Massachusetts. Yep.
How big of a town was it?
You know, Framingham at that time was actually considered one of the largest towns in the country of the United States.
Oh, really?
Now, because the demographic has changed there, the population has probably gone from over 100,000 to down around 60 or 70. But when I was there, there was a lot of excitement and activity and a lot of sport. And, of course, that's the lifestyle that I fell into and that brought me ultimately to Framingham South High School. And there I met and was mentored for many years by probably the most influential coach and figure in my young adulthood, a gentleman by the name of Phil Smokey Morazy.
Smokey,
that was his nickname. We called him Smokey.
Everybody had a nickname back then.
That's right. And he, you know, he taught me the game and to love and to respect the game. And I'll tell you a great story. You'll enjoy this. I was just 13 going on 14 and in eighth grade getting ready to go into my freshman year at Framingham South. And I was a big kid. I matured physically very, very young. I was almost my height that I am now back then. And I told my friends, I said, I'm going to go down to Bowditch Field, which was the football field, but they had a basketball court outside, and I'm going to play with the older guys. My friends say, get out of here. You can't go down there and play.
It's the only way to get
better. I said, man, I'm ready. I'm going to go play. So I did go down there, and they went with me to watch, and I got in the game because, you know, those days you used to play, you know, 5-on-5 right. Till 10 or 11. If you won, you stayed on the court.
If you lose,
lost, you were out. Yep. You could be gone for hours.
Yeah.
Anyway, I got picked, and I got in the game, and my team.
Wait, you got picked as well? You were.
I was big. I was a big kid. Yeah,
but you were young.
People didn't know who I was, but I was big. And we won the first game, and I stayed on the court, and you know, and played for a long time, and you know, just felt great because I did pretty well against the older high school guys. And when I finished, I walked off the court, and this man walked up to me and said, hey, you're a pretty good player. And I sort of nodded him off disrespectfully. I'm like, yeah, yeah. And he goes, where are you going to go to school next year? I said, I'm going to Framingham South. Again, kind of disrespectfully, he said, do you know who I am? I said, no, I don't know who you are. Again, not kindly and nicely. He said, well, I'm the coach of Framingham South High School. He said, do you want to come play for the high school team? I said, yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Changed my tone. And he looked at me and he said, well, I got one piece of advice for you if you want to come play for this team. I said, yes, sir. What is it? He said, cut your hair.
Oh, man.
Because I had this really
had big
long hair. And you could tell that I was a kid that was a little wild and a little undisciplined. And not that is the most important thing, of course, right. But he was sending me a message.
A message, exactly.
You know, he was telling me, if you want to be a part of this team, you got to do things a certain way. You got to fall in line with the principles and the culture that we have here.
Yeah.
You know, he just taught me an invaluable lesson that probably to this day, not in terms of the hair, but in terms of expecting guys to think team first,
right,
and to go along with the culture of the organization and of the team. And you know, when I find myself here in Olympiakos, I think back to my coach, Smokey Morazy, back then. You know, you're part of a team with great history and great tradition Fortunately, I've had some experience with those things, and it just makes me comfortable, you know, very comfortable.
It was a Jewish upbringing from day one.
Well, I was from a Jewish household,
right.
Jewish parents. We were not particularly religious, but certainly
you attended the Reform
I went to
Temple,
Hebrew school
until your
twice a week, but you know, I went to public school myself, and you know, that is part of my background, and certainly became a deeper part of my mentality and culture when I did eventually make Aliyah or immigrate to Israel. But you know, there was some college in between that time and the high school
Any
days.
Any other sports when you were young? Or just
I played everything. Basketball. No, you know, I was
that was back in the day when we
back
were
in the
able,
day. Remember how we used to all
volleyball, tennis, basketball, tennis. Didn't matter.
Mostly though, in Boston, it was football.
Football.
It was baseball. It was basketball, and it was hockey because
right,
that's a cold,
exactly.
You know, a cold.
Same thing. I was Rochester, New York.
Yeah, there you go. Same thing. Yep. So I played all four sports.
How'd you get to Princeton?
I did at the end of my high school career receive a lot of offers to go and play because I had a an all-state high school career and fortunately because my mom was a school teacher I was influenced to do well in school.
Exactly.
And when the time came for me to choose, I sort of was looking for the best combination of athletics and academics that I could find. And at that time, Princeton was sort of a powerhouse of the Ivy League schools, and there I thought I could find the best possible match. They had ultimately a Hall of Fame coach, Pete Carril, and it seemed like a good choice for me at the time.
Was it under scholarship, athletic, academic?
Ivy League at that time, and still to this day,
did not have scholarships
because I came from a broken home, and my parents were not that wealthy. I qualified for a good bit of financial aid. But I was lucky to get a great education, to learn a great deal about the game of basketball from Coach Carril and from the Princeton system, which I can honestly tell you I have never used.
That was one of my questions coming.
Let's say I've never used on the whole in my professional career, but certainly I use elements of it and bits and pieces and fundamentals that I learned when playing in that system, and it served me well.
It's a difficult system to teach to a group of players. You can maybe teach one or two players, but it's a system in whole as a whole. It's hard.
You kind of gotta get guys that you know from the get-go can handle it.
Right.
Second thing is you got to expect there's going to be a very long learning curve. And in professional sports, you don't necessarily have 3 or 4 years to put a system in or to play a certain way. Princeton offense is Coach Carril's offense, and that's why he's in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I saw that you wrote your thesis, and a little bit of ignorance on my own part, okay?
Sure.
I saw that you wrote your thesis on The Natural. Of course, my first thought was the movie.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, that's amazing that you know that, and I appreciate that. I was an English literature major.
But let me ask you about it real quick, because I read into it, and the book was written in 1952, and it was more based on mythology than... In my mind, my first thought was, okay, Coach wrote a thesis about the relationships between a man and a woman and what happened, unfortunately, on that train ride and so forth and so on. And then I thought, I got to look this up a little bit more. And now we're talking about the Holy Grail, and we're talking about a lot of different things.
Well, see, that's just amazing that you've come up with that because it's very true. The two most influential things in my life outside of basketball, of course, were literature, particularly the great Greek myths that I learned and read in detail as a young child. And ironically, of course, I find myself today in the hotbed in the heartland of mythology, of all of the real deal.
It's not called Greek mythology for nothing, right?
No, exactly. And that of heroes. And The Natural was a story, of course, that was full of myths and of genre that played to the hero, both victorious and fallen.
And fallen, yeah.
I like to take the good, positive side of it because, you know, being one that grew up with the appreciation and the admiration for heroes, whether it be the great Greek warriors or whether it be sports heroes like Bill Russell, who I grew up with as a child, listening
hometown
to Johnny Most on the radio at, you know, 8 and 9 in the evening with that little transistor up against my ear. Because in those days,
old. People
don't know what that is now, but I certainly do. You know, I still have a cauliflower ear from that transistor banged up against my ear, you know, late at night. But I was fortunate. You know, I was living in the land of heroes. That was an era that had the great Red Sox teams with Collier Stremski, the Triple Crown winner in 67 and pennant winner. That had the great Bill Russell with 11 out of 13 championships in the NBA. We had Bobby Orr and Phil Esposito. Oh,
that's my idol.
So, you know, these were the people that I looked up to and that I admired and sort of, you know, became role models for me as sports heroes.
You end up in these Maccabi games.
Yes, 81.
Again, you're teaching me a lot of things. It's the third biggest event in the world.
That's correct.
After the World Cup and the Olympics.
Olympics, that's correct.
That's amazing.
It is an amazing thing. It's
over 150,000 athletes participate every year. Now it's every 4 years, I said, but it's...
Yeah, it's every 4 years in Israel.
Right.
But they have smaller competitions around the world for Jewish athletes and for, you know, the chance just to allow people to get to know one another from all over the world and to experience a shared ideal and a shared ideology encompassed by the sport itself, which is, you know, just such a great thing. So I was lucky to participate in those games. Some great players on that team. One, for example, his name was Danny Shays, who, you know, Danny played in the NBA for 14 years. Yeah. His father, Dolph Shays, was one of the NBA's original greats. The world is a small place. Dolph Shays went to NYU with my father.
No way.
Back in the day, you know, so it's just kind of amazing.
Dolph Shays is back in the Mike and Drill
days.
Oh,
yeah, sure, sure.
George Mike and days.
Yeah, 40s and 50s.
And that was 81. You graduated from Princeton.
I graduated in 1981.
Did you stay in Israel at that point? Did you return?
I did. I played in the Maccabi games, and then I came to Israel. Started my professional career.
Never came back to the States?
After 3 years, I did.
Okay.
I felt like maybe I needed to put my great college education to good use. Better use than playing professional basketball at the time, and I came back to the States for 2 years and went to work for Xerox Corporation, which at that time was a
Rochester, New York.
There you go.
Yeah.
But after a couple of years, I sort of realized, hey, this is not really what I want to do. I love playing professional basketball, and I came back to Israel. My obligation as a dual citizen, I had to do the Israeli military, which I did.
That was my question.
I did the Israeli military, and I of course, continued my professional career, which I played for 13 years until I was, ironically, injured with a complete rupture of my Achilles tendon.
Oh, is it tendon?
Apropos, because I was an enormous, enormous admirer and had such a great appreciation for the great mythic figure, Achilles from the Iliad. Who lost his life at the end of the Trojan War by being shot in the heel, his only vulnerable part, because he was a demigod, and died. Now, I'm far from being Achilles or Achilles, but indeed...
But you are a demigod.
I don't know about that. Certainly not that. But I did find myself in the same predicament that he did. Not literally, because literally he died. Figuratively, because my career as a professional athlete finished with an Achilles tendon injury. So it's kind of ironic.
Yeah, it's ironic, but I mean, this whole the whole mythology thing keeps coming back.
Keeps coming back, man.
That's the thing.
That's right.
And did you coach your wife?
I did. I can tell you that.
I'm afraid to ask.
No, no. One of the great, and I'll clarify it. One of the great and first, actually, the first professional title that I ever had as a coach was of the Elitzur Netanya women's basketball team. When I was playing, every year in any team or city that I played, I always asked the management to let me coach a youth team or a team that
while
was connected.
While you were playing?
While I was playing. Because, you know, you have a lot of time.
So you had the coaching mentality while you were playing? Were you one of those point guards that, like...
Yeah, well, certainly I was a point guard that thought the game pretty deeply. And I also... You know, I just wanted to have a little bit more to do. So I always asked a coach. I enjoyed working with youth. I enjoyed working with players. I was not thinking about this being my full-time, lifelong career. To be honest with you, I just wanted that additional experience while I was playing rather than sitting and, you know, doing nothing for hours a day. I wanted to sort of round out my experience. So I coached the women's team, which my future wife played for.
You won the championship.
We did. We were not dating at the time, but a year later, I came back to that city and I ran into her, and lo and behold, some years later, we were married with four children. So
She would have scored a lot more if you would have met her, you know.
She was a great defensive player, to
She's
be honest
a defender,
with you. Yeah.
There you go.
Her sister, who was married to a guy that I played with on that team, now my brother-in-law, she was the scorer on the team.
There you go.
Yeah.
Now, she's got to, because she knows the game and she knows the lifestyle, had to be a huge support throughout all these years of you moving from one place to another, coaching here,
no question.
There.
Kinnaird was one of the reasons that I was able to have a long, successful career, both as a player and as a coach. You know, and I'm fortunate to have her as someone that always knew and understood what the game is about, what it meant to be in the profession, and how you sort of had to deal with somebody like me in that position.
It's a lot of sacrifice for
a great deal, you know, especially if you also got to raise four kids at the same time. Now,
three daughters
and a son.
Wait, get to the son later.
We'll get
Don't
to
worry
him,
about
yeah.
it. I have one daughter.
You do.
And I can't feel any older. You're 6 years older than I am, but my one daughter has me looking older than you.
It's amazing.
How do you do with three
it's
daughters?
It's amazing. Well, yeah, first of all, they're good kids, and she has always been a terrific influence and mother figure to her. Now, you know, unfortunately, the years that I've been in this on this journey, which has taken me to so many different places and countries and many, many times, you know, has taken me away from everyone. You know, it had its impact on us in terms of our marriage. Although to this day, we are still the best of friends and still very much responsible for all of our four wonderful kids in the way that we can.
Tamir's still playing.
Well, you know, he's only 21 years old.
Right.
He's going to be playing for a long time.
You gonna have a chance to coach him?
You know, I worked with Tamir a lot when he was younger. When he turned 16, we were still very much in the throes of me, you know, spending time with him on a daily basis, working him out, until suddenly I realized that it was time to be more his father than to be his coach. And I think that worked out really well for him and for our relationship. You know, we're closer than close. But he was able then to move on and to develop and to work with a lot of other people and in a lot of different situations without me being over his shoulder. And I think it was the best thing for him. And obviously he's taken that and had great, great success at such a young age. And I'm proud and happy for him.
That's like that old adage where you can't teach your kids, you can't do homework with your kids.
That's
but
right.
But you can bring in a tutor.
The
tutor can do it.
You know,
someone from outside.
The good thing is that he's a very motivated kid, and you know, he's got an innate ability to understand what and where he is and what he needs to do. And he's got a heart that drives him to be the best version of himself. And, you know, that's what we all want for all of our children.
Yeah, that's just,
whatever it is, whatever field
it
is.
It
doesn't
matter what it is.
Just want them to,
tell
you
my
know,
kids that all the time.
Love things and be the best version of themselves that they can be. And then whatever happens, you live with it.
You brought up in Boston. I'm upstate New York, and you know I was shocked when I came over here and started playing. And all of a sudden, I'm traveling to Yugoslavia, to Croatia during civil wars, where you know I can remember like having to duck down on the bus at one time to go through. You know, and I can remember laying down on the floor of a bus and thinking to myself like, what am I doing here? You lived in Israel.
Yeah.
There's so much unrest in the area. Was anything that impacted you, affected you directly in your life?
I was being in Israel for so many years. I've gone through some extremely trying and difficult times for the country. When you're living in a small geographical area and you're surrounded by six or seven countries that have declared war on your country, you're bound to run into some very, very difficult and uncomfortable situations, and that's even to this day. But the Israeli country, the Israeli people, the Israeli military are very, very strong and very committed to a man and to a woman to protecting the rights of their citizens and to seeing a sustainable and flourishing country for today and forever. I'm also proud to be a part of that culture, and I've benefited greatly from it. And what I'm really left with is, boy, wouldn't it be nice if we all could get along a little bit better and everybody could live in a way that would allow them as people and as a country to be the best version of themselves. So unfortunately, it's not what I'm seeing
right
in the world, but that's certainly the way I'd like to see it, and I believe that's the way the Israeli people would like to see it.
Was there ever an incident that just that really made you sit down and say, I got to get out of here, I want to go back to the States?
When you have children and things are happening, yeah, you think when you're in a bomb shelter because Katusha rockets are being shot into your backyard, you do think about it.
Just give me the chills thinking
but,
about it.
You know, also once you've served in the military and you recognize that part of your obligation is to help the people that you live with and live for survive, you don't necessarily think about getting up and leaving. You think about what can we do to remedy this situation and how can we serve and protect. That's what you.
So your army stint wasn't cooking dinner.
Oh, no, because I went in the military a little bit later than most, because, you know, a normal Israeli who's born and raised in Israel doesn't come at the age of 22 like I did after college. They're going to go in for, the men will go in for 3-year obligation, and the women go in for 2-year obligation. I'm proud to say that my fourth child, Ella, who's just turned 20, has just finished her 2 years, now all of them have done the Israeli military. I did it. I myself did a year, and I was not in a fighting unit. I was in a supply unit. But you're part of it, so you feel it and you sense it, and you contribute in the way that you can. And you know, it's part of your experience.
You told me to let's get off of that stuff now, and let's get on the coaching here.
Good idea.
Yeah, you told me today that the other day was your 800th win as a coach.
Yeah,
all
here
time.
In Olympiacos, the first game of the year in a cup game. We won the game, and a day later, a really nice Greek reporter wrote me, did you know that you just had your 800th win in your coaching career? And I said, I did not know. But boy, that's interesting and exciting and special, because, you know, 800 wins is a landmark. The first question I asked him when he told me was, how many losses did I have?
Yeah. That's a coach's mentality.
That's the coach talking. He said, well, you had 330.
Give me my percentage.
Exactly. He said, you had 334 losses. I said, what's that percentage? He says 70.5%. I said, well, that's good.
That's not bad.
That means
all.
More than the 800 wins.
Yeah, I'm draining 7 out of 10
there
shots.
There you go. And, you know, and what that meant to me was that obviously I was fortunate enough to work with some great assistant coaches and some great players. And the second thing was that I showed, you know, myself and others that if you make a commitment to excellence and to doing things in the right way, then you have a chance to be successful over time. And when you have a long career like I have, you know, that means something. You know, if it's one season, still it's important and it says a lot about your year. But when you look over the course of 25 years and you say, hey, you know, that is something that sort of justifies what I've been doing all this time.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
And that's a good feeling. That's not the end all be all, but it was a nice thing.
But numbers are important in this game.
Well,
they always will be.
It, like I said, it means something.
You coached under Pini and Gershon.
Yes, I did.
For a while.
Yep.
And was he a big influence on you? Did you learn? Obviously, you always learn from a head coach when you're
sure.
assistant. First of all, was he that big of an influence on you when you were that assistant? Did you learn a lot from him, or did you have your own philosophies?
Well, I'll tell you more than just having worked together with Penny as a coach. I played for Penny.
I was his captain
in Maccabi Haifa in 1983, 84.
That's right. I forgot about that.
And I've known Penny for many, many years. And I've always said that he is one of the more imaginative, visionary coaches that I came into contact with. Obviously, you know, his great career speaks for itself. We had a great professional relationship filled with fantastic achievements together, and I feel lucky to have worked with him and to have taken in a lot of the ideas and knowledge that he had about the game. You know, and I think that he, together with some other well-known European coaches, is truly one of the great coaches that Europe has known.
you took over the ranks of Maccabi Tel Aviv. Was that a, I don't know if it was a dream of yours or not a dream of yours, but it's a great club and everybody wants to take over that. But then in 03, 04, he comes back and right. you take the assistant coaching job. Was it a demotion? Was it?
Well, I'll tell you, that was a very, very particular time. And honestly, the real reason that I stayed was because they notified me late for the beginning of the following season. But I also knew when I decided to accept staying that it wasn't a demotion, because in my years working with Penny, to his credit, he gave me a great deal of responsibility and he allowed me to feel very much an associate head coach of the team long before people started talking about associate head coaches.
Right.
Penny was already doing it because he was, as I told you, he was a very imaginative, visionary guy, and he knew well that I could offer him and the team a great deal if I had a lot of responsibility, and he was man enough and smart enough to give me that role. You don't find a lot of guys that would have done what Penny did. And I, you know, obviously it helped me a great deal. The team did extremely well. You know, we won the Final
Four
that year.
Incredible year.
We won it before I became the head coach, and then again when I went back to being assistant, we won it again. And that just further prepared me for the kind of long career that I've had.
And after that, you took off for 6 years.
I did. I felt like, you know, I recognized that, you know, it was time for me to go out on my own and to blaze my own path, so to speak, which I did. I'm happy to say I had a lot of good years and a lot of great places and a lot of great countries, together with wonderful experiences of countries and relationships and shortening the gap between peoples of different backgrounds, and, you know, and just allowing me to take this incredibly diverse, valuable journey in my life.
Well, one of the things I was most surprised about is you seem to be more of a person of continuity and time and everything else, but you spent six different teams in 6 years, pretty much. I mean, short stints here in Greece and Ardis, I think it was, right?
Yeah.
But you were successful throughout those years.
Yeah, I don't know if it was six different teams in 6 years, but close. I mean, there were some teams that were 2 years. There were some teams that 1 year. Generally, what was happening was one of two things. Either we were really successful and then I got a bigger job, you know, or in one or two cases, there were problems with the team financially, which happens, unfortunately, in Europe, and I had to move on.
But like I said, they were successful. You had the 2004 Euro Cup in St. Petersburg, Coach of the Year.
That's right.
During this time, you were also Israeli assistant coach.
The national team.
And then, then the Russian national team. Also,
yeah, which is a big part of my career, you know.
Huge.
When I was asked by the great former player Sergei Tarakonov and the then head of the Russian Basketball Federation, Sergei Chernov, to come and be the head coach of the former Soviet Union, now Russian Federation, being myself an American child of the Cold War with a Jewish background and an Israeli passport, you can only imagine what was going on in Russia when that decision was made by some very forward-thinking people. And I just relished the challenge and the opportunity to cross barriers and join hands with forward-thinking people that just wanted sport to win out. And you know, Joe, that turned out to be, for both of us, for both Russian basketball and for me, one of the great, great basketball stories, you know.
It's because an amazing story. You beat Spain in Spain.
In 7 years, we won three medals, including
bronze in the Olympics.
European championship, a bronze medal in the Eurobasket, a bronze in the Olympics, and played some great, great basketball for seven consecutive years.
I'm not here to pat you on the back or anything, but they weren't really, at this point, on the way up.
Program was very much down.
Right.
You know, I remember well, I came in and I did two things which were not received particularly well by the brass of the administration. First thing I did was say we're not going to practice three times a day, which was left over from the Soviet era.
Yeah,
and the second thing I did was I announced publicly for both the people and for the players that anyone that doesn't want to come doesn't have to be here. You can imagine what happened when I said that. But I wanted to create a culture. I could go to the players and say, I want you to come to the national team because you want to be here and because I am going to make you better. I am going to help you during this period of time become a better basketball player. And at the same time, allow you to serve your country and your country's sport in the best possible way. And thank goodness that guys like Andrei Kirilenko and J.R. Holden and Sergei Monia and Anton Pankrashov and Vitali Frizdon and eventually Alexei Shved, who we'll see pretty soon in the competition, and so many others, they bought into that and they responded to that.
I was just about to say, you have a way of making people buy in. I don't know if it's a tangible thing that you have, if it's a philosophy that you have, but you have a way of you see, I saw it today in your practice. People are buying into your attitude, your philosophy, your way of coaching. And I think that's what the Russians did. Although I did hear that you kicked off the team by Alexei Shved and Sergei Monia in the middle of a game.
In the middle of a game, middle of a timeout. I did. That's a great story. That's a true story, by the way.
I can't believe it.
I'm gonna tell you, I had a thing. You know, I love my guys from the Russian national team. They were such hard workers.
They would jump
through a wall for you. But one thing I always noticed, you know, the Russian players were very quiet and very stoic, except when things weren't going well. Suddenly, everybody wanted to talk. Everybody had something to say. You couldn't get them to talk normally.
Well, you know, that was the whole thing against the Russian teams. You're like, just get a lead.
Right.
Just get a lead.
Yeah, and then everybody got upset and started
exactly.
talking. So I said, I made a rule. In timeout, nobody talks but me. That is an absolute rule. I said, and if you talk in the timeout, you're out. You're off. So we're playing a game against Brazil. This is the Olympic Games, okay?
This is in the
in
actual
the Olympics.
This is like a preliminary.
No, we're in the Olympic Games in London. The whole world is watching, okay? And we're struggling in the game. And I come into timeout, and I'm telling them what we're gonna do, and everybody's talking, and my captain Sergei Monia, who's a lovely guy, I love him, and Alexei Shved, who, you know, arguably might have been our best player in the Olympics together with Kirilenko, they were talking and they wouldn't stop. I said, okay, Monia,
to themselves or
amongst
at you,
you know, in the middle, no, not at me, to you know, to each other. I said, Shved, Monia, you're out. You're gone. They're like, what? I said, get out. You're off. You're off. You're out of here. Go, you know, go sit on the side. I kicked them off the team. Now, a quarter and a half later, we fought our way back to the game.
Without them.
Without them.
Uh-huh.
And I came over to them. You know, you can be right and you can be smart. All right? So I decided this was the time to be smart, not right, because we needed them. And I know that their heart was in the right place. They
right.
just, they broke the rule broke temporarily. Them. So I said, guys, I'm going to give you another chance. Come on back. And they helped us win the game. So
there you know, go. Another so good much, coaching
so,
move.
So much for tough love. You know, I mean, that's what that was all about. But, you know, my experience with the Russian national team and the Russian national team players was just so special to me. And I'm so thankful. Those are the kind of things that you remember, not just for the titles, but for the experience of being part of that culture.
Well, I think it's what you explained before, the small kid from Boston,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
with the
my
Israeli
background
passport.
And becoming the coach of the former great Soviet Union, you know, I mean,
it's all part
it's
of
an amazing story.
Yeah,
you know?
It's all part
is,
of your
it's
story.
It's kind of consistent with how my life is going. You
and
know?
The big part of your story was 2014. I was there to watch it.
Yeah.
What a spectacular Final Four. What an incredible season. Was that the most gratifying thing to you up to date?
Yeah, well, you know, it's hard to rank accomplishments, team accomplishments. It's hard to rank them, but you know, obviously the 2014 EuroLeague championship was special in terms of the group that we had that was not favored to make the Final Four, certainly not to go to the final and then not to win.
Let's not even talk about the semifinal game. Against
the semifinal against Chesco, or even the quarterfinal against the would-be home court Final Four team, Milano. But, you know, it was such a special group of guys that truly believed that together the sum could be greater than the whole of its parts. And that's, you know, that's exactly what it was. We were...
But again, it goes back to the buying in thing. You have you have people buying in.
You know, Joe, I've always believed, and I tell this to young coaches who I lecture to on a fairly frequent basis. You know, I always tell them that, you know, being a coach is many things, but five of those main things, you know, really start with, number one, knowing the material. Number two, you know, having a philosophy that works for you. Number three, being a teacher, you know.
Saw that today.
Having the ability to teach people. Number four, maybe not the least but the most important, to be a human being, you know. And number five is to share and to give and to show your passion for the game on a daily basis in the way that makes your players want to buy in.
You're kind of walking me into my next bit here, is your philosophies, your the way you are. I've watched and admired you for years as a coach. And you know, when you're an old player also, and you know, when you're growing up or you're getting older and you're like, thank God I never played for that coach, you know?
Yeah.
And then you see the coach like, man, I just wish one time I get a chance to play. And you're one of those guys. What is it? Is it your passion to win? Is it your passion? I think it's the human being part of it. It's a respect.
You know, I started with the fact that my high school coach, Phil Morazzi, he was more than a basketball coach to me. He was a mentor for life. And I so valued that ability of his as I tried to my own to influence, you know, young people and to help them to see the right way and to play hard, play together, play to win, and to have fun. You know, if you can give that to your players and to your people, I believe they'll want to play for you. You know, if you sell that aspect to them and show them that path, I think players want to play for you.
When I watch you sometimes in games, you have your moments.
Oh, yeah.
You definitely have your moments.
Oh, yeah.
But I have to ask you, because you do it so you're here, and then you're all the way up, you're screaming, yelling, and then you're back down again. Is it sometimes a calculated?
Sure. You know,
sometimes you're just angry.
I'm not an actor at heart, but you do utilize, you know, various tactic in terms of trying to motivate or trying to create a situation that could ultimately function in your favor. But you know, as I get older in my career, I'm probably less animated and dynamic as I once was, and maybe a little bit more thoughtful. But that goes, you know, that goes with the experience level. Also, you know, I can tell you when I look back at the way that at times I behaved, I say, geez.
Don't we all?
Yeah, that's pretty regrettable. I wish I had never done that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Fortunately, that's something we all do in life.
It embarrasses the hell out of me, to be honest with you, when I see it.
Most of the time now it's on video, and you can get it on YouTube, and you get it everywhere.
And believe me, my kids send me the YouTube clips all the time, Joe, because I'm telling them, don't curse.
Yeah.
And don't act.
Oh, they love that. They love
out
to
of
get
order.
You.
Oh, they get me. You know.
They
the get me, and you know. And what can I say? I mean, the tape don't lie. You know
what
I mean?
Exactly.
You're listening to The Crossover with Joe R. Lucas, the brand new podcast from the Turkish Airlines EuroLeague.
The biggest basketball event of the season takes place this year in Victoria Gasteiz. That's right, the Turkish Airlines EuroLeague Final Four comes to one of the best basketball cities in Europe. It'll take place May 17th through the 19th, 2019. The tickets will be going on sale November 6th, so go to www.f4tickets.com to be sure that you won't miss out on the hottest event in European basketball. Dardo Shafaka was just unbelievable 2 years.
What a great story.
They get in the Euro Cup, you show up, or in the Euro League, I'm sorry, you show up and you take them to the quarterfinals. I did a couple of games there. A beautiful stadium, number one.
Yes, yes.
It was just a great atmosphere there. And then you even went into the playoffs and beat Madrid. I think it was the second game, game two.
Yeah, yeah.
And man, you put everybody, like, you put that team on the map. And, you know, and Madrid's a class team. You know, you knew you weren't going to beat Madrid 3 games in a row. It was a tough one, but you put them back on the map, and that was an unbelievable year. And then I did game one last year of the Euro Cup. And I know you. I see you smiling already at me.
Amazing story.
It was just amazing. Yeah. You guys came back. You fought your way back into the game, and then you get that stolen pass at half court on the inbounds pass, which is a rule change this year. Now you can choose to take it in the back court because that's a hard place to take the ball out.
No question.
If you don't want to score,
that's right.
And you steal the ball, and I'm watching, and I'm going nuts. I'm watching Scotty Wilbekin running, and I forgot who had the ball.
Howard St. Ruse, he stole the ball.
Exactly, he stole the ball. Yep. And Scotty's looking at him going, give me the ball, well, give me the ball.
Need
and
3 points.
He drills the three,
yeah.
And you won the series right there.
Yes.
I mean, it was the dagger.
That's true. Well, that whole experience was special because Dachka, you know, was not a team that was on the map. They are now.
Right.
But also, you know, the team that originally was sponsored by Dogus, which is a very big, wealthy concern in Turkey, and allowed us to put together a very strong team our first year. That second year morphed into something else because Dogus left the team and we went back to being just Darüşşafaka, who, of course, is a traditional team from the Turkish league that is centered and operated by a school of orphans. And helping to develop these young kids into future leaders and successful members of the Turkish society. And it was a special, special environment to work in. And of course, you know, they're considered kind of underdogs, as we were,
of course,
as a team. And we carried that mantle proudly and successfully. And we really, really benefited from the support of the Dachka kids. Well,
it's like you're playing for somebody.
You are, you know, and I did what many did not, but I opened the gym for every practice for any kid because we practice in the school itself.
Oh, really?
So I opened the gym. Any kid that, you know, was not in class or, you know, was off, they would just come and they would be in our practices and they would be in every part of our day-to-day affairs. And, of course, a lot of people got behind the team and We were fortunate to have a lot of young guys that wanted to make a name for themselves in the game. And, you know, there's nothing like committed effort and the desire to get better and help a team do well as a unit. And that's what we had there. You know, it was a special situation.
Did you feel it was okay to leave because you brought them back to the EuroLeague? Did you have that sense of, okay.
Closure?
I don't know if it's closure because your first year, there was nothing wrong with your first year.
No,
it was an incredible
wasn't.
Year.
Honestly, I had a 2-year contract.
Oh, okay.
And I was in the second year of my contract.
Right.
And my expressed desire was that after the second year, I was going to try to get back in the NBA to get a head coaching
That's
job.
That's been very publicly stated.
I'm very public times. About it. And I didn't hide that from anybody. And when I finished my second year with the championship, of course, I did indeed go and interview for 4 different NBA jobs, was very close on a couple of them. But, you know, sometimes you finish second and then that doesn't get you the job.
Was one of those jobs a Knicks job? I'm assuming.
Well, you know, I don't even like to talk.
You have a foot in the door
I don't
there.
Even like to talk about, like, who and what, but I will say that, you know, I did have that strong desire, and when it didn't happen, I was so fortunate that I was able to speak with and ultimately come to work for such a great traditional and special organization like Olympiakos, where I am today, and I'm so happy and proud to be here.
I've done enough research on you to know that, you know, the whole NBA experience is a little bit touch and go with you, and, you know, at times you don't want to talk about it, but I just want to kind of base it around about what's the difference between coaching an NBA team and a EuroLeague team?
Well, to the first, let me put it to rest. I am not sorry for a minute that I spent in the NBA. That was an amazing experience. I went to work for a club that initially wanted to rebuild and to ultimately become a playoff contender, and very quickly, due to a variety of circumstances, was able to build a team with some of the best players in the game. Obviously LeBron and Kyrie, who was already there, and then the trade Kevin. For Kevin Love, and of course our
did
designs.
Did the trade happen? Did you trade for Kevin, or did
I was there? Yeah, when we traded for Kevin, and I was also there when we renewed Kyrie to his long-term contract, and of course was there when they were able to bring LeBron in. So you know that situation morphed very quickly from a rebuild to a championship or bust situation.
A lot of pressure.
Yeah, and I got to tell you that you know, if you ask me if I would try and do the same thing again, I would say who wouldn't want to coach LeBron and Kevin Love and Kyrie and that whole gang on the same team and have the opportunity to do the utmost. And indeed, we in my first year we went to the NBA Finals, and without Kevin and Kyrie, we even won two games against the great Golden State Warriors. So. Despite in the middle of next year being released and obviously not feeling great about that, I still do not regret a single day that I was there. And probably the second part of your question, which is what are the main differences between the NBA and the European game, is the answer to the question, because it is a very different environment, and there's so many more things that go into being in an NBA environment or an NBA coach than just the game itself. You know, I think here it's more about only the game, and there it's about a lot more things. Now, this is not either good or bad. That's the reality. That's just the way it is. And I needed time to learn that. I didn't really have time to learn it, you know, in the way that probably would have served me better. But that's the way it came out, and honestly, I'm not sorry for it. I was an Eastern Conference NBA champion and an NBA finalist, and I took my shot. I'm where I'm at, and I'm happy, and no complaints.
I speak a lot to kids about, you know, basketball wise or life wise. Every time I speak to a group of kids, I try to put everything in perspective as life, not just basketball, even though most of the times I'm talking basketball kids. And I always say that, you know, your greatest game doesn't make you a great player, and your worst game doesn't make you a bad player.
Great point.
And you have to stay even keel, because life throws these curveballs at you, so to speak. We'll use our upstate Boston, New York terminology.
Yeah.
This was a major curveball, because you're on a pace to win 60 games that year. You're leading the Eastern Conference, and boom! How do you deal with that? How do you deal with that news?
Well, you know, it's funny, because after game one of the NBA Finals, which we really were close to winning, we lost only in the very end of the game. We had the last shot. We lost in overtime.
I remember that.
You know, everybody was asking, you know, do you think this was your chance? You know, are you
got to win that game on the
road?
Yeah.
Are you guys done? I said, look, there's no shame in getting knocked down, but it's shameful not to get back up again and try. I remember I said that. After that first game, and the very next game, we came back and we won. in an amazing fashion. And then we went back for game three in Cleveland and won that game two, and we're up 2-1 without Kyrie and without Kevin.
Sorry, without Kevin.
And with Dele, who had just spent himself because of playing all out. He had nothing left. He went to the hospital for 24 hours. He couldn't get out of the hospital
bed. What a series he had.
To exhaustion.
He had to chase those guys around. He's chasing Curry around, Clay Thompson around.
I mean, it's just amazing what he did. But, you know, you're going to get knocked down in this business, Joe. You know, and I certainly know. And again, there's no shame in that, because sometimes somebody's better. Sometimes somebody's stronger. Sometimes you yourself weren't good enough. But the question is, what do you do the next day? You know, how do you face that? That's what makes, I believe, an athlete, and that's what defines a winner. It's not the best of the moments. It's how you deal with the tougher moments and then come back and show your mettle.
You know, life's a learning process, and you don't learn from successes. You can, but you learn so much more from
generally
the tough times,
we always say that as coaches. We always say that as coaches, the best time to get better is after you lose.
Yeah,
after you lose a game.
And now you got that ring, but I heard that you denied it at first. Was that a pride thing?
No, I didn't. I did not. I never denied it. It's not true. What I did was I thought about it.
Okay.
I did think about it. And then when they called me, David Griffin, the general manager, called me and he said, you know, we want to give you this ring. And I sort of asked him, you know, why do you want to do that, you know? And he said, because it's earned, not given. And that's
the key right
spoke
there.
To me, you know, because indeed that team, you know, and that staff, you know, I was very much a part of putting together. And for a year and a half, we were pretty doggone good. So they felt that I had contributed to the championship. Now, I didn't win it, but I had contributed to it. And I thought, you know what? That's enough for me. So I don't think
that's any different than a player being injured during the season and not being there at the end. I mean, you
built. I respected what they did, how they presented it. I respected it greatly, and I accepted it. Now, one day, probably what I'm going to do with that ring, if I don't leave it as a heirloom to my children, I will auction it off for a good cause or a charity.
There you go.
Because I won't wear it.
Is it pretty?
It's beautiful.
Is it?
That's a beautiful ring.
You haven't put it on?
Well, I tried it on, but I don't wear it.
You won't wear it anywhere.
You know, but it'll be for a good cause one way or another. Not to mention it feels pretty good to be a part of a number of great European championships on a number of different levels and then have an NBA ring to boot.
Well, I think the personal thought to me was I've read how you handled questions about Tyronn Lue. And you've been extremely respectful because, I mean, you know, you can have a little bit of a angry side, but you've been extremely respectful towards him. It seems like you've supported him even throughout the time.
Sure, I brought him.
Yeah.
You know, what kind of person would I be if I had any other kind of attitude? It wasn't his decision.
No, of course not.
It wasn't his decision. So, there's
a lot of pride in this sport.
Yeah, no, I didn't look at it that way.
All right, let's bring you here. Let's bring you back to Greece and finish this thing off. You've been extremely generous with your time, and I want to let you go here. But
yeah, I got to go see my son play.
Oh, he's got a game now?
Yeah, he's got a game that I hear in Greece.
Oh, really?
He plays against Ike in Greece. How about that for irony?
There you go. Okay, let me get you out of here then. The team looks great. I just saw the practice. I love the camaraderie of the team. I love the fact that you're going to get Olympiacos running, but you got a great mix of vets. You got Spanoulis, Princesses, and you got some raw talent.
Papa Nicolaou.
I love Milutinov. This kid is phenomenal. Plus, you brought in Alex Toupain, who looked great today.
And
how important is the beginning of the season to get this team to gel? Well, it seems like you have it.
Yeah, we have. You know, we've had a good preseason, minus the unfortunate two and a half weeks without eight of our players, who are national team players in the window.
You don't want me to ask you that question.
Well,
you
know, I already spoke out on that.
I know.
I really have. I just like to see those competitions take place when all the best players can play. But you know, we're doing our best to build this team for today and for the future. It's going to take us time. We have many, many new pieces. And we have a mix of older veterans and younger players that, you know, take time to gel and to work in a way that brings out the best in each of them. I'm blessed with great leadership and experience and performers like Spanoulis and Printezis and Papanikolaou and Mansaris, guys that have been through it, have championship DNA. We've been fortunate to bring in some great young foreign players. We have a few foreign players that played for us last year in Milutinov and in Strelnicks who are, you know, terrific. But, you know, I'm not trying in any way to undervalue where I think we can be and should be. But it's going to take time. It does not happen in a day. That's not realistic. That's not responsible.
I got bad news for you.
Tell me. Everybody wants it to be.
It's got to happen now, first of all. But four of your first six games are on the road.
Yeah, really.
Six of your first nine games are against playoff teams from last year.
Yeah, we were not blessed with a great schedule.
No, the schedule is not in your favor.
What I'm saying. You know, we may take a few hits.
Right. It's not how you start.
It ain't how you start. It's how you finish, buddy. That's exactly right, Joe.
All right, to finish up here, man, give me a quick scouting report on a few players. Spanoulis.
One of the all-time greats in European basketball.
Doncic.
In my mind, the number one pick in the NBA draft who will have a great, great career.
Scotty Wilbekin.
Just a wonderful kid and story who has worked his behind off to become the great player that he is.
Sergio Jewell.
You know, no doubt if he would like an NBA player, but I so appreciate the fact that he wants to be a lead player for the great historical and traditional powerhouse Real Madrid. I respect him for that.
I respect. I don't understand it, but I respect it because he'd be an amazing NBA player.
Sometimes,
too.
You know, the desire to be happy and comfortable goes over anything else, and I respect him greatly for that.
My last two, Tamir Blatt, scouting report. How do you stop him? How do you shut him down?
A kid that you got to recognize that he's about the right things, and that he can hurt you with the pass, the dribble, or the shot.
A triple threat.
And that's the thing that you really want from any player, particularly young players. And he's my son, so I love him.
And the last one is David Blatt in the playing days. What was the scouting report on him?
Depends on what phase of my career. You know,
the good phase, the best phase.
Competitor, just a competitor that wanted to win and to help his team be better.
Coach, I don't know what to say, man. It's been an hour, and I didn't expect
awesome,
to keep
Joe.
You that long.
No, I thought this was great. One of the best interviews I've ever done.
Thank you. Your patience, your generosity, your openness. Just thank you so much.
It was a lot of fun for me, man. I sure appreciate it.
I appreciate it. And I appreciate you teaching me about some mythology.
There
also.
You go, man.
Coach
there you
Blatt,
go.
Thank you very much, my man.
Thanks for listening to The Crossover with Joe R. Lucas. If you like what you've heard, subscribe now so you don't miss an episode, and leave us a review on iTunes and Apple Podcasts. Don't forget, tickets for the 2019 Turkish Airlines EuroLeague Final Four go on sale on Tuesday the 6th of November. Visit f4tickets.com to make sure you don't miss your chance to be part of the biggest event in European basketball.